Hi everyone, just before we get this next History Hack out and going, just a quick reminder that there are lots of ways you can support the pod. Remember, just by liking, subscribing and sharing it with your friends, that is invaluable as it gets the word out and our witterings can go far and wide. But if you're able to support us financially, that would be incredible because it helps us keep doing what we're doing. In the description to this episode, there are links to Patreon where you can support the podcast regularly, and Ko-Fi, where you can tip us for an episode that you like. But we've also got some merch. So if you head to shop.historyhackpod.com, you'll be able to see some incredible bits of merchandise featuring the incredible designs that Steve Smith does for every episode. We've got some totes on there, some mugs, and we got more stuff coming all the time. So please do check that out. And if you are able to support us financially, that is incredible. Thank you so much. But even if it's just liking, sharing, and telling everyone we're incredible, that helps us too. So without further ado. Hello and welcome to History Hacks, dedicated Second World War air power podcast, hedge hopping with me, Matt Bone. Today, I've got my first returning guest. We got John Bernstein back with us, who you may remember from our chat about P-47s a little while ago. But today, we're going to be having a very different conversation because we're going to discuss a very personal story about one Wellington, her Canadian crew, a replacement infantry officer waiting to deploy, and a crash outside Exeter that brought them all together. So, John, thank you so much for coming back. How have you been, mate?
Not too bad. A little under the weather lately, but otherwise doing pretty good.
And he's just picked up a beautiful little puppy.
Yes, she just wandered in. Gotta pick her up in order to keep her quiet.
But yeah, I'm very dog broody at the moment, so that's not helped me at all, mate. Thanks for that.
She's there.
We've been chatting about loads of things recently, but when you told me this story, it basically needed to be a podcast. So we're going to be talking about your grandfather, aren't we?
Yes. Yes, we are. And sort of the origins of my interest in World War II. My granddad was my best friend throughout the first 32 years of my life. And, you know, this started with just sort of as something I did to honor him after he died, and expanded far more than I ever expected.
I can see that. And I know a little bit about this, and I'm really looking forward to hear the rest of it. But let's start with his footlocker. So why is that an important part of our story? And to spoil this a bit, why do you have a chunk of Wellington bomber in Virginia?
Well, my grandfather, like you said, was an infantry officer in the 83rd Infantry Division. He came into the division right at the end of the Normandy campaign, and fought as a platoon leader and then later company XO through the end of the war. Let's see, when I was 3 years old, three or four, somewhere around there, he pulled out his footlocker for the first time, which had all of his uniforms and the stuff that he brought back and photos and everything. And it was my treasure chest as a kid growing up, whether it was wearing his overseas caps, or in eighth grade, I actually started to fit into his uniform. So I wore it to school one day. I used to carry his musette bag as my book bag. I mean, it was just what sort of molded me. That, and just the fact that he and I spent so much time together throughout my life. When I commissioned, I was pinned with his second lieutenant's bars, and he and my grandmother were there at my commissioning and everything.
That was brilliant.
It was wonderful. They and my parents and my now wife came out to Fort Lewis, Washington from New York, and were there for my commissioning. And it was just, it was amazing to have him there and be pinned with his lieutenant's bars. So it was, you know, we lost him about a year later, but still that was sort of one of the defining moments of my life.
And okay, we got to ask this. As a straight infantryman, what did he think about you flying Apaches?
It was actually funny. He told me, if you're going into the army, you can do anything but be an infantryman. He said, you absolutely will not be an infantryman, or you will have to deal with me. So yeah, he was pretty much dead set against it. He said, you want to be a pilot? Great. I love pilots. Pilots were great. He talked a lot about P-47s and P-38s, providing close air support for him. So he was all about that. And when he learned that that's what I wanted to do, he was excellent. Go for it. So yeah, he was definitely dead set against the infantry.
So So in his footlocker, he has had, you now have, a piece of this aircraft. So let's start delving into this story a little bit. There it is. Yeah, that's a hefty bit of metal.
It's about a 6-inch piece of sheet metal. Now, with the construction of the Wellington, I've been trying to figure out exactly where this came from, because you've got that geodetic frame. But this is a piece of sheet aluminum. So I figured it's probably either from a leading edge or possibly a turret fairing or something like that. But it's not part of the main structure of the aircraft. And it's a crumpled piece of metal. And on it is written, fragment of Wellington bomber, crashed 5 July 1944, Honiton, England. And what I've been trying to figure out since I started looking into this is what an infantry officer in England was doing at the crash site. And it's led me on quite an interesting journey. It's not done yet by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, I've certainly learned a lot about the crash and the crew, and I still haven't figured out why he was there, other than the fact that I know he was in Exeter as a replacement waiting to go across the channel to link up with the unit that he was going to fight with.
So let's ask about this bomber. So it's a Wellington 10. What do we know about her before she joined the unit that we're going to be talking about?
So she was serial number HF485, and she was posted to 466 Squadron prior to that. I know one of the crews that she flew with, because Mr. Tony Cairns was the son of the tail gunner on HF-485 on her combat tour. And he actually sent me a number of photos of the airplane. She did carry some nose art. She was coded N for Nancy. And so there was a female figure, just sort of a head and shoulders painted on the nose of the airplane. And she was called Nancy. I know she flew, it was 30 some odd combat missions with 466. And I have to double check, but I had gone through and was able to place her on at least 30 some odd. And after that, she was posted to number 82 operational training unit in, I think, November of 43. And then she was with 82 until June of 44, when she was transferred to 86 operational training unit, which had just stood up. Now, it's interesting because the crash report says she was part of 82, and another document that I have says she was posted to 86. So I'm sure there's some transition time in there, considering it was only, you know, what, 2.5 weeks before that they stood up 86 OTU. So it's just sort of interesting to see that. And I've written to Q to see if they can scan both units' ORBs for me, because they're not digitized yet, but I'm waiting on those right now.
It's always the ones you want that are not, but the aircraft bounced around those OTOs like they're, you know, it was almost like who needs what, don't they? So they get passed around a huge amount. So let's talk about the crew, because you knew me and mentioning a Canadian crew, I jump at the chance. So where were these guys from? Clearly still in training, but what do we know? You've mentioned the gunner, but how about the rest?
It's interesting. The crew from the operational training unit were actually all experienced guys. They had been flying coastal patrols, or a number of them had been flying coastal patrols in Canada, off either in the Pacific or out of Newfoundland for a solid year before. Now, the pilot was Frank Lauren Burston. He was 30 years old. And he was an experienced Hudson pilot. The navigator was his brother, Glenn Richard Burston. Both of them were from London, Ontario, as was the bombardier, Richard Vernon Dupe. So they were, I guess, the forward half. And then warrant officer Douglas Gordon Bush, DFC, was the radio operator. And he had previously been with number 11 squadron. And he was originally out of, forgive me if I pronounce this wrong, but I guess Kelowna, BC.
Yep, that's it.
Okay. And
it
then
just so happens to be a Tempest 2 taking shape in Kelowna, BC as well.
Excellent.
As an aside, but there we go.
what were typhoons in there somehow too? So, and then we've got the two gunners, Sergeant Owen Miller out of Toronto and Sergeant Neil Scott Herder out of St. John, New Brunswick. And I wasn't able to find any previous experience for the two sergeants, But everybody else had been either with 145 or 11 Squadron. And Bush actually earned his DFC. I've got the citation here. If I can just find it. Yeah, here we go. So award effective 5 May 44 as per Canada Gazette of that date. Warrant officer, as a wireless operator air gunner, has been employed continuously for a long period on anti-submarine operations, during which time he has displayed exceptional keenness and ability in the performance of his duties. He has participated in 4 attacks on enemy submarines, 3 of which he's been credited with as the one who made the first sighting. So, wow. Lots of anti-submarine work there. And I'm not sure if he flew with the Burston brothers. Actually, I don't think he did, because I think they were with 145 Squadron at that point. So they all sort of came together in England, but they were all flying these similar profile missions in pretty much the year leading up to them getting to England.
That's fascinating, especially the two brothers on board. So you've got a highly experienced crew still learning each other out by this sort of stage, which I suppose is not something we tend to click a lot. You sort of think the OTUs are the boys straight out of school getting used to it. You're not always thinking that this is actually a new crew, yet a highly experienced crew that may have been doing different profiles beforehand.
Exactly. Yeah. You would think that with all their experience, they probably gelled pretty quickly. Now I can't find the document, but I found something along my search that said that they were actually on their last training mission. You know, it was an operational sortie over the continent, but it was their last mission as a training crew before being posted to an operational unit. So that sort of makes it, you know, doubly tragic. Here they were pretty much all ready to go, and you know, the worst happens.
So let's talk about this. We have an experienced crew flying a very interesting op. So what were they doing on 5 July?
They were flying a nickel mission, basically a leaflet drop over the continent, where they were dropping propaganda leaflets trying to get the Germans to surrender. They flew out over Normandy, turned west. I'm not sure exactly where the target was, because I haven't found a mission report yet. Hopefully that'll be in the ORB. But they made their drop, and then they turned out over the Channel Islands. And waiting for them were 6 radar-guided 8.8 centimeter FLAC 36s and radar guided searchlights as well. Now there are over 175 anti-aircraft guns on Guernsey, apparently, mostly under the control of FLAC Regiment 292. So as they turned out over the Channel Islands, they took fire and their right engine was hit. We know this because the crash report, you know, says that the right engine was feathered. There were signs of fire. So what I've been able to piece together is, as they passed over Guernsey and were hit, right engine caught on fire. And so obviously fabric-covered airplane fire is not a good thing. And they weren't able to control it. They weren't able to get the fire out. And checking the maps and everything, and Google Earth is a phenomenal tool. So I basically looked at where they were and where they crashed. And what I was able to figure out is Glenn Burston was a phenomenal navigator. He shot an approach that was just dead on. I mean, it was absolutely perfect. He got them within 3 miles of the end of the runway at Exeter from Guernsey. And unfortunately, what looks like happened, the fire either burned through the control cables in the wing, or it just burned off enough flying surface that they weren't able to maintain flight anymore. And they hit the farmhouse at Livermore Farm, and the airplane exploded. And that was it, unfortunately. But he got them all the way back, or almost all the way back. I mean, just amazing.
And 3 miles is nothing. After that, they must have almost been breathing normally by that point.
I mean, runway in sight and everything. So, yeah, I mean, it's just awful.
So here we are. We've got, unfortunately, something that's reasonably frequent, a bomber crash landing in southern England. Mm-hmm. And here's your grandfather waiting for something. You've already said you're not exactly sure what he was doing in Exeter other than waiting, but he's there, and we believe he gets involved in the direct aftermath, doesn't he?
Right. I mean, what logically I sort of figured out was, okay, they probably pulled a detail from the replacement camp at Exeter and said, hey, we need help fighting the fire or something along those lines. And something brought him to that location. So, I mean, it could have been, hey, it's just souvenir hunting. Oh, there was an airplane crash and we picked this up and bring it home. But knowing my grandfather, he's the kind of guy who got into things to help out. I mean, he would, we always used to joke around that my grandparents would help anybody and get to know anybody wherever they traveled around the world. They were always meeting people and getting to know people and trying to help out. So knowing my granddad, he was there to help out.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask you a few more questions about him in a minute, but you've managed to track down some of the family members of the crew. You mentioned the tail gunner's family before. What's come out of those conversations about the men on the plane and the sort of what you found out about that last stop?
Well, one of the really interesting conversations I had was with Mr. Byron Lambert, and his father flew with the Burstons, and he happened to be posted to a different squadron when they all went out, but they were all together in 145. And he said that Frank Burston was a hell of a pilot and knew his airplane and was a really excellent aviator. So knowing that, and knowing that Glenn was an excellent navigator, both through Mr. Lambert and from just what I've been able to piece together. So it was really just it helped reinforce how capable these men were. They obviously were not novices. They were very experienced aviators. And so it was really kind of cool hearing that from him. Also spoke to Diane Burston, who was Glenn's daughter. And she and I just talked sort of about what I had found, and she shared a couple of things that she had found over the years and stuff. And that was really neat, just talking to her. And she was very appreciative that somebody, of course, was remembering her father and her uncle. So that was really an emotional phone call. And it was a number of years ago now, but still, it was really just very, very cool to hear. And then I also spoke to Mr. Martin Pemberton, who was Vernon Dupe's nephew, and just sort of getting to, he pieced together little things about the crash too. So we were able to share some information. But it's amazing how when you get into doing the research, how many other people are involved and how many other people have questions and are sort of looking into this. And it was it's really neat to be able to pull all that together into a story. And it's quite a compelling story. So
it is. Yeah. Well, I guess the question I'm trying to ask really is, as this has started to come together, what have you learned about these guys? That it seems that there's a little bit of color coming in each time you piece a little bit more. So what sticks in your heart about these men?
Well, first of all, that the Burstons and Vernon Dupe were a little older. I mean, Dupe was the oldest at 31. Frank was 30 and Glenn was 28. The other three were 21 and the two sergeant gunners were both 20 years old. But, these men had established lives before the war and were, college graduates. I've got Book of Remembrance from London, Ontario as a piece on each of the three boys, you can see them there.
Yeah.
But just one of the things we sort of take for granted in researching airplanes and stuff, or at least, I did for years, was I'm focused on the airplanes and the missions flown and everything. And this has really brought in such a human element. And this was, I first started looking into this in 2006. And this was probably the first thing that really started me on the human stories rather than just the missions. And it really, it had such an impact on me as a historian that it altered my view on how to do history. And that's really been pretty amazing.
I know that feeling. You find a story that clicks, and then usually that story has an abrupt ending. And then you realize that person was 21, 22, and you're sitting there as a, 35, 40 year old gentleman as we are.
Yep.
And then then there's another one. And we joke about planes and typhoons and drugs quite a bit. But I think for both of us, that focus is the other way around. It's the man in the cockpit that's far more interesting than the aircraft.
Sure.
And again, so many lives cut so terribly, terribly short. And the thing that's interesting about this crew is you've got what were considered old men and old hands that are here, which is really quite fascinating. But I think that's something we probably all need to try to talk about a bit more. Is it's easy to compare plane to plane, but the human element, especially by this point where you've got men of this experience going through an OTU, ready to go into an operational squadron, going up against literally boys on the other side and in the flak regiments that they'd be facing.
Sure.
So let's change tack, because I want to hear about your grandfather a bit more.
Okay.
So you said he got deployed. He ended up as Company XO, but what happened to him? He's had this sort of first realization of war with a burning bomber, but what happened to him when he deployed?
So he was actually on the continent about 2 weeks later.
We have to stop. Have been calling him your grandfather this whole time. Tell us his name, sir.
He was Lieutenant Julius Carl Goldman, and he came in through 90th Replacement Battalion over Utah Beach and joined up with the 83rd Infantry Division, specifically 2nd Battalion, 330th Infantry Regiment, on 24 July 1944, right at the end of the Normandy campaign, just as they were about to jump off on Operation Cobra. And he came in as a replacement officer leading 2nd Platoon, because the 83rd, specifically 2nd Battalion, 330th, had been mauled in a pretty intense battle just a week or two before. The 83rd lost a number of men on one of their first major combat actions. And so they needed to bring in a number of replacement officers to lead their infantry platoons. And my granddad was one of them. So he came in, and he often said that he got there and his platoon sergeant came up to him and said, "I'm glad you're here, Lieutenant, because I really didn't want to jump off on an attack without an officer here." So pretty much they went right into the Cobra breakout within a couple of days after that. And he successfully led his platoon pretty well with the outbreak or breakout through Normandy and then on into Brittany, where they went through, I can't think of the name of the town. But anyway, they went through Dinard and then on to Saint-Malo a couple weeks later. And of course, there was the fortress there at Saint-Malo, which was the major strong point that eventually the division reduced. And they were there because they needed the port facility, and or the U.S. needed the port facility to start bringing in more, beans, bullets, and Band-Aids. And the problem was the Île de Cézambre was right off the coast, and between Cézambre and the Channel Islands, the Germans had the approaches to the port completely hemmed in with artillery. So my granddad always talked about this because he said September 2nd was a lucky day for him. It happens to be my birthday, but September 2nd, 1944, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he was supposed to be in the lead landing craft hitting the beach on Cézambre to retake the island. The morning of September 2nd, the island surrendered. And so 2nd Battalion 330th occupied the island, and he was instrumental in negotiating the surrender. And the reason for that is because he spoke Yiddish. And so he was able to translate the Germans and communicate enough. And so he was able to negotiate the surrender of the 400 or so Germans, Italians, and Ukrainians on the island without firing a shot. And so he was actually awarded his first Bronze Star there, which was pretty cool.
And we can't really underestimate just how nasty a fight Saint-Malo was. We don't, I think I only know about it because I had a fantastic dinner there once.
Right.
So you start learning about it. Of course, Lee Miller was there taking photographs.
Yep.
Napalm was used. It's a fascinating, very, very bloody battle. And of course, I've just brought up Google Maps. That island is in the worst possible place, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is.
It is. I actually covered it a little bit in my book, which comes out in 2 weeks. We talked about last time, but yeah, I mean, they
quick, really give it a plug.
Oh, of course. It was P-47s versus German light and medium flak from Osprey Publishing. It's for their
all good and evil bookstores.
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, the flak defenses there were pretty formidable. And as you mentioned, they used quite a bit of napalm on the island. In fact, there's a really interesting shot of one of the artillery pieces there that's just completely melted from a direct hit by a napalm. So yeah, I mean, and actually one of the really cool things I got from my granddad was the aerial reconnaissance photos of the island. Oh, and so I have large format photos with his handwriting all over them, denoting machine gun emplacements and bunkers and all sorts of obstacles. And they really knew what to expect as they were coming in. Of course, he's sitting there, okay, platoon leader from the lead platoon, he's the first guy off the landing craft. And of course, if you've seen, you know, the beginning of Saving Private Ryan, you know how that goes. So he always sort of credited that September 2nd was, like I said, was his good luck day, because he didn't actually have to be the first guy off the landing craft into the withering machine gun fire.
I always find it remarkable that those platoon leaders, so many of them were killed, but at the same time, so many of them survived. It's the hazardous positions. It's the first guy over the parapet. It's almost seen as replaceable as unfortunately that's what your grandfather came in for. But what a fascinating little thing, and amazing to have his preparations for a battle that didn't need to happen, because good sense seems to have prevailed. Not that there was a lot of that going on in St. Malo. I'm just trying to remember the name of the German garrison commander, because he was
von Orloff.
Yes,
Orloff.
He was a strange bloke. But we won't talk about that.
The mad colonel.
Anyways, so what happened next? Where does he go? What does he see?
They go down through Brittany and then Loire Valley and end up in Luxembourg by September of 1944. There's a great photo of him and three of his sergeants sitting at a table in the town of Stadt Bredemis. And he was very fond of pointing out that the next day a V1 hit that building. So he said they were still there. And of course, he said it hit. And the first thing that out of his mouth was, "Where's my helmet?" So he was there and fortunately did okay. The Germans were right across the river from them, but it was still a relatively quiet sector. And then they moved up to the Hürtgen Forest and saw quite a bit of action there. He was sort of the 83rd in general, went from hotspot to hotspot throughout the war. They were one of the most combat divisions and one you hear the least about. I think overall, as far as U.S. Army division casualties, they were fifth overall. So really just a hell of a lot of combat experience from just after D-Day through the end of the war. And of course, right after they got hit pretty hard in the Hürtgen, they get moved down to the Bulge the day after Christmas. And he said that the most intense combat he was in throughout the entire war was in the little town of Stirpigny, Belgium, or Stirpigny, as I should pronounce it properly. He always called it Stirpigny, but yeah, Stirpigny. I've been there three times now. And he said it was the largest tank battle that he ever witnessed, because the 2nd Battalion, 330th, was attached to the 3rd Armored Division at that point. And so they were working directly with the Task Force Richardson, and which was, I believe, part of Combat Command B of the 3rd Armored. I'd have to double check that. But yeah, I mean, they were sort of the counterattack phase of the Bulge. A lot of people are aware, you know, the Bulge kicks off on December 16th. The Americans get pushed back, hold the line, and then eventually by the first week of January, the campaign's over. Not true. The campaign actually continues on until January 24th, when the lines are finally to where they were on December 15th. And most of the really intense fighting is in mid-January. And the battle around Stirpigny and Gouvy and Langlier was really, like he said, the most intense combat he saw throughout the entire war. He lost two of his senior NCOs there, one just before that, and then one during the battle there in Stirpigny. I actually was fortunate to be able to visit their graves at Henri Chapelle when I was there a couple of years ago. But, you know, it really was incredible terrain. There was, think they were going against the 9th SS Panzer Division at that point. And they were just Panthers. I think there were 5 Panthers within this tiny little town and a number of other assault guns and stuff like that. So just amazing that he got out of there. I've seen some film footage of it and everything too during the, because there was actually a Signal Corps camera team there with them during the battle. So it was kind of amazing to be able to see that with the just the driving snow and everything. And then of course he took this great photo of Panther 412, which was knocked out right in front of the church there, which I've been able to sort of recreate when I was standing exactly where he was the last time I was there and took a photo of the church, which was just pretty amazing to be able to do. So yeah, I mean, and then in February of 45, he's promoted to Company XO and is basically running the company until the end of the war. And then I believe in late June, early July, he gets up. He has enough points to go home. He needed 85 to go home and he had 102. Wow. It's for time on the line and awards and wounds and things like that. So he had 102 points. And so he transferred to the 99th Division and came home with the 394th Infantry Regiment and was back in New York by December of 45.
December 45. So that's literally 18 months from entering combat to being home. That's some turnaround. But wow. What a fantastic tale. And in that footlocker that came home was a small part of HF 485, which is an amazing story. Because I guess that would have followed him around the whole time when his kit caught up with him.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been in his duffel bag, I would assume, wherever they garrisoned after the war, it would have caught up with him. And it is pretty amazing that he was able to keep a hold of it throughout the entire war.
There's a nice sort of little bit of symmetry there that a little piece of those brothers, that crew, was able to finish the job that they were hoping to be a part of as well. And I think that's a really nice line that's through there. And it's great that you're being able to tell us a story there and hopefully listening to this, there's someone out there who wants you to finish writing it all up.
You know, fantastic. I mean, you're right. I mean, it's a piece of them made it to Germany, and they were there for the end of the war, which is pretty incredible. It would have been great if they were able to see it firsthand, but you know, their memory lived on, and I firmly believe in that things happen for a reason, and was able to take this piece of aluminum that just most people wouldn't look twice at and give it faces and names and for lack of a better term, souls.
Okay, thank you, John. That was absolutely fascinating. And to learn about your grandfather as well, taking hedge hopping onto the ground for a change. That's a new one. I'm sure there'll be complaints. Yeah. Twitter being what it is.
Well, I mean, I have to get in the plug for, you know, Close Air Support there, because, you know, one of the things that he really sort of always did talk about was getting P-47 and P-38 support and always the morale factor and everything there. So we talked about that fairly often, especially when it became clear that, you know, that's what I was heading into the Army to do. So, yeah, I mean, he loves Close Air Support, you know, more than anything about the Army.
And yeah, just let's geek out a little bit, especially that the push to get the line back to where it was on 15th of December. Sure. We can praise the 9th there, because they were constantly in the skies, weren't they? Even Absolutely. In pretty crappy weather, they were still answering calls.
Sure. I mean, that's one of those things where there's sort of been this acceptance of, oh, the 9th Air Force wasn't flying until a couple of days after the battle started because the weather was terrible. No, they were absolutely up and flying in ridiculously terrible weather, fog and everything, but they were doing, you know, incredible jobs. They may not have been right up on the front lines providing close air support, but they were still hitting supply lines and trains and truck convoys and everything and stopping that material from getting to the front lines where it was needed.
Because it was the weather getting colder that actually led the 2nd Tactical to start flying as much as they did, because they were waterlogged for most of October and November up north.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, I was just reading a thing to say, as an aside, 127, the old Canadian wing, there's a note in their wing ORB that they'd requested Sunderland to operate from their base in Belgium, because they'd just been completely waterlogged. They hadn't been able to fly for about a week.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, my granddad was up in the hurricane there, and that's where he talked about trench foot and just being completely soaked to the bone. So yeah, I mean, that makes total sense.
Seriously, this has been really, really good fun. So thank you so much, John. Let's get your book a plug, because I was thinking it was about now, and it is now time for P-47 versus Flag. So one more plug. We'll put it on the bookshop so we can put it in the description for this.
Excellent. Yeah, it should be out on October 26th, and which is, 5 days from now? Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's from Osprey Publishing in their dual series, and look at sort of how American tactical air power matched up against German light and medium flak. And it was a fascinating study, especially when I was writing it. I was the director of the Air Defense Artillery Museum. So I had a flak Bierling 38 and a 3-centimeter Jabuschreck and a couple of the actual guns there at my disposal. So that was really kind to be able to do that.
Yes, go back in John's Twitter feed, folks, because he has a lot of very cool toys, even in his new role with the Marines, but we won't talk about them. Super. John, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. And I know it was a bit short notice to jump in, but it's been fantastic. Thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Always happy to be here, man. Looking forward to doing it again.
Thank you.
So take care.
I'm delighted to say that P-47 Thunderbolt versus German Flak Defenses, Western Europe, 1943 through 1945, by Jonathan Bernstein, which is published by Osprey Publishing, is available now. If you check the description in this episode, you'll find a link to our very own bookshop where you can buy John's book, but also all the great books from our recent guests as well. The bookshop can be found at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, where 10% of every one of your purchases comes to supporting the podcast. Thank you so much for your support, and thank you for listening.